to continue speaking about Ehe Dogen's text, Fukan Zazengi, his universal recommendation for sitting meditation for Zazen. And you actually have the entire text in front of you. It's very short. So you could just listen, or if you're the kind of person where this is nice to do, you can look at the text too. It starts on page 13. It's like four little half-size sheets long in English, about 600 characters in Chinese. And this is the fourth talk on it. So it seems there must be some things to say. And I won't quite finish tonight either. Maybe next time I'll finish. Dogen is a very important ancestor. And Zen has a great sort of emphasis on ancestors and the sort of ancestral line, which comes largely from East Asian culture. I'm sure they appreciated ancestors in India, but it's, I think, was particularly emphasized once Buddhism came to China and to Japan. And there's sort of a feeling in the air there that the ancestors are very present. And you know, we're such a new culture, you know. Most of our cultural forebears, you know, have not been in this continent very long at all, just a blink of an eye, you know. So they've been there for thousands of years. And so Dogen being an important ancestor, we study his texts. And he's also an unusual Zen master in that he wrote a lot. And somehow pretty much everything he wrote survived, which is kind of amazing if you think about it. All these wooden temples in Japan were constantly burning down and being rebuilt, and there were civil wars and foment and shoguns and, you know, samurai and all this crazy stuff, you know, going on from the 1220s and 30s into the 1240s when he wrote this stuff, and now, and somehow it all survived. The very beginning of the text starts, I made a big deal about this in the first talk, the very beginning of the text, and you can see here if you want to look at it, doesn't talk about the sort of problems of being a human being. The very beginning of the text doesn't talk about our problems that we might address with meditation. Because we come here with problems, right? We want something, some improvement or some help, you know, or at least a nice way to spend the evening. You know. But the beginning of this text starts with an sort of explication or an exploration of sort of ways in which reality is actually already perfect, the ways in which our lives as they are, are actually just exactly what they need to be. Even with problems, you know, even with suffering, even with death happening and illness, you know, and maybe we have noticed this more when the sun came out last Friday or whatever it was, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? It's like this sense of, oh, that's right. And it's not like, you know, Bellingham or Washington or the world is really that much different when the sun came out after that long, cold, wet spring. But, you know, there was a moment there of remembering, you know what I mean? Did you all experience that? You know, like, oh, yes, this is a wonderful place. And, you know, it's so easy for us to focus on what's broken. And it's not that that's not real in its way. But the beginning of Dogen's text reminds us there's nothing wrong. There's nothing broken. That's a certain sort of warped and confused point of view that you bring here, and you can let that go. He says in here, everything is perfect. The way is all pervading. How could you fix that, you know, with your effort? And how could you think that you could fix anything? I mean, we're so small, you know. The whole body is far beyond the world's dust, he says. Who could believe in a means to brush it clean? And everything is just right where we need it. So he starts there, and then he goes on to talk about our attitude in practice. He brings up ancestors, and he goes on to talk about our attitude in practice. And it gets very practical. So this is the sort of bottom of the first, no, the top of the second page. Sort of the top of the second page. Or the middle of the second page, excuse me. He says, for meditation, you want to have a nice quiet room. You want to be a little mindful about what you put in your body and your mind. And you want to settle yourself down. And you want to stop this incredibly pervasive habit that we do so constantly that we don't even notice of dividing the world up into good and bad, right and wrong, me and them, him and her, right? Male and female, war and peace. That every one of these concepts has a sort of sense of division, and they're provisionally true and provisionally sort of useful. You know, we can't really function without this, but we're in some way caught by this constant sort of dividing. So they talk about dualism in Buddhism, that's what they mean. But he says that the sitting meditation is an opportunity to drop that, to stop that. And it takes quite a while. We have to practice for all to even notice how constantly we're doing that. And sometimes when people first start meditation practice, they're a little bit surprised. So you would think that meditation would help you be like calm or something. But when you first start meditation, maybe some of you are just starting meditation, you might have noticed between 7 o'clock and 7:40 that things were not necessarily always calm. Maybe they were calm. Were they calm? That there's a kind of foment in there, you know what I mean? There's a lot happening. The mind is producing all these thoughts and concepts, and they're connecting and hooking and grabbing on, and the body is producing sensations, which is triggering more thoughts, which is triggering more sensations. And it gets very sort of gnarly in there. And so Dogen's saying, that's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. Actually, remember, you're perfect. But you could stop giving so much energy to this, I want to do this right. I don't want to do this wrong. I need to try harder. I'm not trying hard enough. All these things. So he says in the text, the way it's translated, do not think good or bad. Do not administer pros and cons. And not only that, not only should you not indulge and energize those kind of thoughts, but why not just cease all the movements of the conscious mind? It's like, well, just stop, you know. So how do you do that? So that's where we ended the last talk. So now you're all caught up. Okay? You're all caught up. So next is going to get very specific. And this is the bottom of page 14 if you are looking at the text. You don't have to. He says, okay, well, you want to know how to do that? Here's how you do that. At the side of your regular sitting, spread out thick matting and place a cushion above it. Sit either in the full lotus or the half lotus position. In the full lotus position, you first place your right foot on your left thigh and your left foot on your right thigh. In the half lotus, you simply press your left foot against your right thigh. You should have your robes and belt loosely bound and arranged in order. Then, place your right hand on your left leg, keeping this straight, you know, right and left. And placing your right hand on your left leg and your left palm facing upwards on your right palm, thumb tips touching. So he's talking about this, oops, mudra. Mine is backwards. Thus sit upright in correct bodily posture, neither inclining to the left nor the right, neither leaning forward nor backward. Be sure your ears are on a plane with your shoulders and your nose in line with your navel. Place your tongue, it's very detailed, place your tongue against the front roof of your mouth with teeth and lips both shut. Your eyes should always remain open, and you should breathe gently through your nose. Once you have adjusted your posture, take a deep breath, inhale and exhale, rock your body right and left, and settle in to a steady, immobile sitting position. So So he wrote, and I've looked at the characters for this, and it's very literal and specific, and it does, it's exactly like it says in English, as far as I can tell. So this section confuses people a little bit when we chant this. So we chant this sometimes in ceremonies. Because I notice not all of you are sitting in the full lotus posture. Or even the half lotus posture. So it seems to be saying right away you're doing it wrong. And there's nothing mentioned about chairs or seiza benches or support cushions. And so one is tempted to maybe just sort of strike this paragraph because it might make people feel inadequate or like they're, you know, not going to be able to do this. That maybe it turns out, despite the fact that they seem kind of nice when we came in, actually this is like a very hardcore sort of spiritual athletic thing. And if you're not up to snuff, you might as well walk. And so it's tempting to strike it, but the reason to leave it in, I think, is the message behind these particular details is it's really important to pay attention to the particulars of how you use the body to do this practice, that it's actually an embodied practice, and the details of how you set yourself up actually really matter. And in our case, not being 22-year-old Japanese men who sat on the floor as kids, we have to make a few adaptations. And so we're working on this actually right now in the Sangha. The practice committee is trying to figure out how, what kind of information and trainings to offer. And for each of us, it's a, sort of a journey of discovery here. You know, what is the most stable, upright balanced posture for this body, you know, the way it is. And there's sort of a balance there in terms of the quality of effort. So we do want to make an effort to sit up a little straighter, be a little more open, to have the legs arranged in a way that supports that openness with the pelvis tilted forward, sitting carefully on the front of the cushion, planting the sits bones. These things really matter because they create stability where you can really be still for 30 or 40 minutes. They allow for openness and freedom of breath. And at the same time, each of us comes to this with our own crooked backs and arthritic joints and injuries and all of it, right? So on the one hand, we're working towards opening into some posture, but we don't really know what that's going to look like for us. And so there's a kind of engagement here with the body that actually matters, and we don't talk about it that much. We enjoy the Zen stories and the wonderful philosophies and the confusing, quirky teachings, but not often do we really talk about the nuts and bolts of setting up the body and paying attention to the body. But nor do we want to get too sort of upset and wound up and uptight about it, because then we just get tense, and that's something I've had a lot of trouble with in my practice, just like trying so hard to do it right. So there is a kind of a doing it right, and there's a letting go of doing it right that coexist here. And some of this is very literal and practical, like this thing about leaning forward and backward, that's really great. So if you really sort of set yourself up carefully on your cushion or on the chair so you're not leaning back, so you're upright, and you could try this now if you want. And take an inhalation and extend the spine a little bit, sort of visualize the spine coming up into the neck so that the upper body is, you know, a little bit longer but not strained, not forcing anything. And then the really being up and upright in both dimensions, to do that, our mind is actually not that reliable. If we can kind of have the body extended and sort of pivoting on the base of the spine, we can actually use gravity as a much truer sense of what is really up and down. So if you just make little arcs from side to side and just let those be smaller and smaller, and are really attending and feeling gravity, you can just let balance and motion tell you what's up and down, what's left and right. And looking around the room, you know, we're all a little skewed, left or right, forward and back. Almost all of us are leaning forward a little bit, so you can also try the same thing, leaning forward and back. Actual balance might feel to you like you're leaning back. I think that's the case for me. I think I've been leaning forward quite a bit lately. And you can just check yourself out. And again, there's a kind of a balance here. We want to allow the mind to settle as much as possible. We want to release from this constant administering of pros and cons. But once in a while during Zazen, we might just check, am I leaning forward? Let's just do a little gravity check here. And yep, sure enough, actual balance point. You know, so it feels to my brain, because I spent half, 45 years kind of leaning forward a little bit, it feels to my brain like I'm leaning back when I'm actually more or less straight up and down. More or less, more or less. Okay? So Dogen says this, in our 800-year-old text, very detailed. Be careful about your posture. It actually matters. And the thing about the position of the legs, it matters and it doesn't. It matters and it doesn't. It turns out the full lotus posture, just the way that the hips are rotated out, really makes a lot of space for the pelvis and allows some freedom there and allows this sort of natural tip, sort of like about 8 or 10 degree tilt forward of the pelvis so that the spine kind of makes this natural kind of S-curve. And so if your body is close to being able to do that, it might be a worthwhile thing to explore that, or it might just cause you pain and trouble, so you have to experiment. But a lot of times the limiting factor for half lotus or lotus is you feel pain in the knees. It's not the problem of the knees. The knees are not the problem. The problem is the knees are a joint just designed to do this, not to do this, right? The problem is that the hips, which are a ball and socket joint, are a little tight, and the hips need to be able to rotate out more than they easily can, and so then you end up taking in the knees. So if you feel it in the knees, you need to work with the hips. So, maybe you go off and take a yoga class, or maybe someday we'll skillfully incorporate yoga and warm-up exercises, qigong, and who knows what, into the Zen practice. But at the same time, which is valuable to do, and, realistic and practical, right? The body is a physical entity, and, these joints work in different ways, and it's not too good to hurt your knees. But at the same time, one of the words that Dogen uses in here, which was always a little confusing to me, you might have noticed if you glanced at the book, he says right in the middle of the second page, for San Zen, a quiet room is suitable. So what is this San Zen? The term that we use for sitting meditation is Za Zen. Za means sit. Zen is Zen. So sitting Zen. So why does he say this San Zen? Which has bugged me for a long time. So I was so happy to finally find out that... I've forgotten again. San means... just means like doing or something. I'm going to have to look it up again. Didn't bring my notes from the last talk. It means something like doing Zen. So for doing Zen. Or another way to look at this San Zen is for Zen is just Zen. For doing the Zen that is just Zen is kind of what he means here. I'm going to have to make one more talk to straighten this out again. So come next time. But it means something like that. And so anyway, there's an incredible value, I think, in this very simple form where you just sit down. You don't prepare, you don't improve, you don't like spend 10 years doing preparatory yoga practices to where you can sit perfectly in the full lotus. You're not like checking yourself, oh, I'm up to 23 minutes now, soon I'll be ready to go to Wednesday night, a few more years, right? Instead, we just sit down. We just sit down and let everything go. And the reason why I think that's really valuable is it's a kind of a great sort of antidote to our tremendous smart powers of improvement and figuring things out and manipulation. To just say, even though I don't really know how to do this, even though I'm confused by this, even though my posture is not up to snuff per Dogen, 12th century, I'm just going to do it. I'm just going to sit. I'm just going to breathe. I'm just going to allow whatever my experience is to be my experience without improvement, without adding anything, without manipulation. And so that's part of why I think the Zen tradition has been resistant to very practical things like having warm-up exercises or something like that. Because there's a tremendous sort of spiritual benefit to be engaging in something that's non-manipulative, that's not improvable, you know, that is just being, you know, it's just being. It kind of helps us to sort of disengage from this sort of endless round of doing. You know what I mean by that? It's endless round. Like, do you think your to-do list is ever going to be, like, done? Does anyone think that still? Right? So it won't, right? Of course. And we need our to-do list, but we have this sort of glimmer, you know, that one day we'll finish our list, right? And it's really not true, and it makes us suffer, right? So this Zen that is just Zen, this San Zen that's just sitting, you know, is a sort of antidote to that, I think. And strangely, very strangely, because this confounds our doing mind. Strangely, and we have proven that here in a 20-year experiment. We've done a 20-year uncontrolled experiment here with some people, and we had them sit zazen every week for 20 years, and they have all changed and grown in wondrous ways. You know, even not knowing what the heck they were doing. So it's now scientifically proven that something happens, even though you think, what would happen from doing nothing? You know, it doesn't make any sense. And yet there is a kind of a sense to it, a kind of a true sense beyond our usual sort of manipulative sense. Not to say you shouldn't take yoga class, though. Go ahead. Go ahead. Just don't think you're taking yoga class to get good at yoga. Like, that would be a mistake. Or get good at Zen. Do yoga just to do yoga. And there's a sense, too, I think, in not here in Dogen's text and in the sort of style of practice, to not be caught by this very sort of pervasive idea we have that we have to kind of have the right conditions. Things have to be right in our life before we can really take this on. Like, you know, at the moment, we're kind of busy and we'll kind of try it, you know. And later, after, fill in the blank, the kids are grown, I graduate, what is it, you know, I have more time after I retire. Later, you know, later. Conditions will be right. Zen practice has a sense of these are the only conditions there are. There are no other conditions. So the only time to practice is now. And that makes me think of Arjia Rinpoche. So I don't know if any of you came when Arjia Rinpoche was here. He was sitting more or less right here about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And so I want to tell you a little about Arjia Rinpoche. Because his talks brought up this theme of not waiting for when things are just like the right conditions for practice. So I thought he was Mongolian, but it turns out he's Tibetan, but his family is of Mongolian, has Mongolian roots. But he was born and raised in Amdo province in Tibet, same province where His Holiness Dalai Lama grew up. Although a little later, he was born in 1950. To a nomadic family. You know, so here's a guy sitting right here who was a nomad as a child. It's amazing, you know, the people you can meet who've just, like, been through so many different lives and places and times. We think of nomadic life as being so, like, thousands of years ago, but no, 1950. And then when he was 2 years old, a strange thing happened, but a wonderful thing in their cultural context. He was recognized as a reincarnated lama. The previous Arjia Rinpoche, he's the seventh or eighth Arjia Rinpoche. So they have this whole system where certain lamas have a lot of sort of spiritual juju and they get reborn to carry on their practice and carry on their work. I don't know, you know, how exactly new lamas come into being, or it's a very complicated system, I'm sure, but he turned out to be a reincarnated lama, and he told us about the systems of divination they used to figure out if it was really him. And you can see movies and read books about this. It's really interesting. And seems a little strange to us, but I think actually makes complete sense from within the culture that it emerged from. And so then, going from 2 years old, he left, or maybe 3 years old, he left the nomadic camp where he had been living and went off to live in this huge Tibetan monastery called Kumbum, where there are 6,000 monks living. Yeah, so like Western. How many students at Western? So, yeah. Okay. So So, like a kind of like a little bit smaller than Western, only everybody lives there and practices full time for 7 years to life, you know, not just 4 years of part time and partying on Friday. So a little more, a little longer. And so he says in the book that it was kind of like he joined a family of 6,000 warm and loving family members. And he had really, it was great. I think his mom came for a while, but then his parents came and lived with them for a while, but then they left. Even when he was pretty young, but it was good for him. He was fine. You know, we find this very strange, you know, take a kid away, you know, from your family at four. You know, like Piaget would not approve, you know. Yes, but anyway, it was excellent. But then, a couple of years in, the Chinese invaded the country, right? So then he had to leave the monastery, and the young monks, at least, were all forced to go to school and learn Chinese and sort of academic topics. And he says in the book, I don't remember if he talked about this in the talk, but he said in the book that he really liked it, actually. The Tibetan monastic educational system is a little, very sort of, lots of repetition and memorization and very little critical thinking skills. And the Chinese system was a little more like a Western educational model. And so he really enjoyed learning Chinese and learning all this stuff. And maybe he was too young to sort of be horrified by the bigger sort of political things that were happening in the background, you know, as his country lost its sovereignty. But then after 3 or 4 years of that, maybe he's now about 10, Mao decided they need to triple agricultural and industrial production in China. So this was the great leap forward. And so all the monks were then forced out of the schools and out of the remaining monasteries and forced onto these huge communal farms. And as you can imagine, Tibet is not a great place to have big communal farms, but they did it anyway. And so now Ajie Rinpoche at 10 years old is essentially, you know, a slave on a farm. But luckily, his tutors are on the same, like, labor unit. And so they just continue Dharma study, you know, hauling the manure and hoeing the fields. They continue to study the Dharma, and he was able to keep practicing. And a lucky thing, too, is that most of their system, the memorization system came in handy because they didn't have any, you know, they didn't have their books. But his tutors had memorized these enormous amounts of material, and so they could work on it orally while they were working on the farm. And so in some strange way, he was able to keep practicing. So you can kind of see where this is leading, you know. Your life is a little better than that, I think, externally. Like, you're not a forced labor, you know, person. So maybe you can practice. And so some of this I heard from some. I read his book, which is in our library, called Surviving the Dragon. He donated a copy. And he talks about as he grew up and sort of became, in some ways, a part of this Chinese communist system. And it was really interesting, actually. We think of Chinese communism as a kind of a brutal dictatorship, which I suppose it is. But actually, from the way he describes it, it's much more sort of nuanced and strange than just like totalitarian oppression and terror. Because there's all these sort of strange, you know, insidious political, philosophical, educational things going on all the time. There's all these committees you have to be a part of and re-education meetings you have to go to and things you have to say and do and talk about. And it's sort of a strange divide and conquer with informants and sympathizers. But the weirder part seemed to be that they all end up sort of half believing it in different ways. And you could kind of never tell who really believes it, who's really just playing along, who's a little bit mixed up in between. And one, any given person could kind of switch from one camp and it's all shades of gray. And actually, after they sort of got through the Great Leap Forward, which then Mao blamed on other people, right? That was the Gang of Four, if you remember your history, and they hung them, so got rid of them. But after that, and before the Cultural Revolution, actually things got better. Actually, things were not bad. They allowed them to reestablish the monasteries, some of them, a lot of them they destroyed. And one of our Ajie Rinpoche's teachers was the Panchen Lama. And so in the Tibetan religious government system, the Dalai Lama and the Panchen Lama are the two leaders. But they're sort of staggered generationally. So when the Panchen Lama gets old and dies, the Dalai Lama is a young man. I don't know how they organize this, but and the Dalai Lama recognizes the new baby Panchen Lama, and then the reverse. When the Dalai Lama dies, the Panchen Lama recognizes the new Dalai Lama. And so they've done this since about the 5th century, I think, they've done this. Yeah, it's amazing stuff. So anyway, one of Ajahn Rinpoche's teachers was the Panchen Lama, and he ended up becoming an important high government official in the Chinese government. And he was able to start this Tibetan college in Beijing and reestablish several monasteries and help Ajahn Rinpoche and his peers get educated. And but then occasionally things would just go all sideways and they'd shut down the monastery again and kick them all back out on the farms or make them go to these enormous public shaming meetings, and some of them get dragged. And you never know if you're going to be shamed, embarrassed, promoted, or killed. You just didn't know. And so this unbelievable amount of uncertainty and just unreality, you know what I mean? We have, I think in Bellingham, Washington, we have a fairly stable consensus reality, right? I mean, we occasionally notice that we disagree, but we basically, we sort of have a consensus about what reality is. Not so in occupied Tibet. You just don't know. And so that happened eventually with the Panchen Lama. He sort of rose up the ranks, and then eventually he sort of overstepped his bounds and got more or less sort of repressed and marginalized. And I don't remember if he was actually in prison, but eventually he was so traumatized by the Chinese regime that he died young. And then there's a whole complicated thing about the new Panchen Lama, which you maybe have heard about in the media, where the Dalai Lama recognized the Panchen Lama as he's supposed to, but the Chinese co-opted their own group of lamas to recognize a different Panchen Lama, who has now disappeared. So anyway, not to go on so long about Ajahn Rinpoche, what does he have to do with Dogen, but everything, I guess. But here he was at our hall, 60 years old, having survived all that and escaped and learned a little Spanish when he was... So how he escaped was he left... he grew a little mustache and he pretended to be Guatemalan. And he flew to Guatemala somehow. And it was this whole, spy movie chapter about, they thought some officials were probably onto them, and they were waiting for their plane to be called and wondering who the informants were in the room and what they making under the plane in their fake Guatemalan outfits and their mustaches, and but they made it. Yeah, it's wild, It's like a movie, but much scarier, I'm sure. And so he eventually made it to Guatemala, and then eventually he made it to America and didn't have any English, had to learn. And here he was talking to us in English. And it was fun having him here. Very happy, very cheerful guy. And very sweet to me. He never quite got my name straight, though, so he kept calling me the master. I was talking to the master here, and he was telling me. So that was fun. I was the master for about an hour. Not anymore. But then his talk was actually sort of rambly and kind of weird and didn't make a whole lot of sense. But what was delightful was just being with him in his presence. But one point he made that made a lot of sense is this point I'm trying to make here at some length. Conditions are always right for practice. Conditions are always right for practice. Because what are we practicing with? We're practicing with this present moment, right? This body, this breath. This mind responding to what's arising. And we think sometimes that we're like a victim of circumstances. And maybe we are, I don't know. But there may be more space, there may be more room there. There may be some possibilities for turning how we respond to this life, turning it towards the light in some way. And so how do we work with the mind? Back to Dogen. How do we work with the mind? So anyway, a little aside there, I guess. But so before you get sent to a forced labor camp, you might want to establish your practice. It'll really help you. And I'm sure that these guys, and women I'm sure that their Buddhist practice really helped them and is still helping them, right? Because 10 million Tibetans are still in the, you know, this is not the past, this is the present. It's a very small number of Tibetans who have escaped, 400,000 or 500,000, something like that, small fraction of the population. And most of them, the better connected, better educated ones, right? But I'm sure a lot of what helped them survive and is helping them survive this is their practice. This sort of essential stance, which is saying everything is workable. I can breathe with this. I can respond to this. There's Buddha here. Even though it looks like Chinese insanity, you know, there's awakening here somehow. And I can work with that. So Dogen, though, after he tells us exactly how to arrange our bodies and our cushions and what to eat. Somebody got mad at me once at a retreat. I suggested that we drink less coffee. That's in Dogen. That's in Dogen. Or no coffee. Well, I wouldn't even think to say that. Anyway, so then he says, well, how about your mind? Once you have, this is the middle of the third page, if you're looking. Once you have adjusted your posture, take a deep breath, inhale and exhale, rock your body right and left, right, so we talked about that. Steady into a steady and mobile sitting position. And actually, not moving matters, so please try your best to practice non-moving. But then it's a question of how do you do it? Is it a tense thing, not moving? Or is it a relaxed thing? So you can work with that. And nobody's going to... Some zendos, they actually yell at you if you move. Did you know that? You could, we have it so easy, right? We have to like occasionally remind you, you know, the things you could be doing. You know? Sticks. I have the stick back there. Sticks. So yelling. Yeah, I know that one of the styles is you have a guy whose whole job is to sit staring at everybody. And if anybody moves, you say, don't move. Don't move. You know, if you believe in that system, it's not funny, but it sounds pretty funny. Anyway, so once you're non-moving, then he says, and this is where like, oh good, he's going to talk about thinking, you know. And we're so oriented around thinking, we would like a lot of advice about thinking, right? Because we're confused by our thinking, yeah? So now he says, think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. And that's all the advice about thinking. Now we're on to other things. So this doesn't make us very happy. So we don't know what to do with this. Think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. That is the essential art of Zazen. So maybe the problem is the translation. That's possible. So remember, we're taking some... This was written in Chinese and translated into English. In America. Our translation was made in the early 70s, so it's even like kind of old, you know. So I did look up all the characters there. Not that I speak Chinese, but I have some good resources. And going character by character, the literal, what might be a more literal translation is a little more helpful, so it could be actually our translation is a little overly condensed. So here's a more literal translation of that section. When a thought arises, bring it into spacious awareness. Okay, that's the first part. When a thought arises, bring it into spacious awareness. So that's interesting. It's not saying get rid of it or anything like that. It's sort of some sense of awareness. There's a thought arising. But the spacious part is important, really important. So sometimes when we're sort of caught by thinking or emotion, things feel very narrow, yeah? Like the thoughts are like, all there is, like, ah! So allow this thought to exist in sort of a broad space. When a thought arises, bring it into spacious awareness. And then it might say, who knows what he really meant to say, but what it might say is, wake up to what is. Wake up to what is. Okay? So be aware of the sort of fullness of our experience. And watch as it ceases to exist. Wake up to what is and watch as it ceases to exist. So if you study thinking for a while in meditation, you know, eventually you start to notice that even really sort of dense and habitual and repetitive thoughts are not really constant. You know, they come and they go. They come and they go. And there's some way that through sort of the momentum and our conditioning and our personality that we sort of, when we're upset or, you know, sort of obsessed with something, we sort of constantly regenerate them so quickly that it seems like constant, right? Like this whirlwind. But actually the whirlwind is composed of elements, right? Composed of thought elements that come and go. So he's saying, notice that. Here it is, it's gone. There's nothing really there to grab onto. And then, it might say, taking plenty of time, the character for time and a large quantity was there. So it's going to take some time. Taking plenty of time, forget all involvements. Taking plenty of time, forget all involvements. So that's not a very good sentence in English, but... So, give the sort of... obsessive quality of this less energy is another way maybe to say that. Don't feed it so much. Don't feed it so much. Which is more possible to do if the body is upright, there's awareness of breath, you're in a quiet room, especially a quiet room with the support of others. There's sort of a certain, did you feel that tonight? There's a certain way you're meditating. Even though maybe your mind is concocting all kinds of stories about the others, besides that, there's a sense of mutual support there. To forget all involvements, to be less caught. And then, it might say, so this is, our translation is really condensed.
This is a lot of specific stuff for what is here, it says
not thinking and non-thinking. I know, yeah. It's bizarrely, ours is bizarrely condensed. And I looked at a couple other translations that were also condensed. So I don't know why the translators did that. And maybe there's something about Chinese that I'm totally missing. But. And then it says, the self will naturally become whole. That's the essential art of Zazen. So then it lines up again. So yeah, it's like four long lines in English could be substituted for this think, not thinking, how do you think, not thinking, non-thinking. And, you know, maybe our clever Zen ancestors just, you know, American Zen ancestors said, we don't want these people to have too much advice, you know. It's just thinking, not thinking, there is no thinking, what is thinking? You can't think thinking, you know. Ha! You know. Maybe their thinking will just sort of collapse under its own weight, which it does, you know. Which it does, you know, if you hang in there long enough, you know, eventually your thinking just, like, you get so tired of thinking, you know. It's just gone. But yeah, let me read that again, this sort of literal possible translation. And I can put this on the website too. When a thought arises, bring it into spacious awareness. Wake up to what it is, and then it ceases to exist. Take plenty of time, forget all involvements. The self will naturally become whole. So this naturally become whole is really important for us too, right? You know, because back to this question of how much are we manipulating the situation, how much are we improving and doing it right and trying to get better, and how much are we just creating space and allowing for a sort of natural wholeness to exist. So yeah, it's interesting, huh? Yeah, what for us is just the key phrase is maybe a pretty condensed and free translation. So I don't know. Another translation is that Kaz Tanahashi and Peter Levitt did is very simple, similar. They put sit steadfastly and think not thinking. How do you think not thinking beyond thinking? Maybe better than non-thinking, beyond thinking. There's something to this life beyond thinking. So maybe that's a little better, but... Anyway, yeah, interesting, huh? So there's a sense here, though, of just allowing thought, allowing it to arise in this spacious awareness, aware that it arises. Sometimes they suggest just very briefly moving your attention there, like, a thought, you know, a judgment, a memory, a plan. I can see that. And then letting it do what it needs to do. And inevitably, it's going to go. Something else is going to arise. That as we practice like this, we start to sort of see that thoughts our thought life is not sort of as solid and real in that way. More like, you know, real in its way. Not real, right? Not real. And sometimes people come to practice and they come to the interview room and they say, oh, I'm still thinking. Doing meditation, no, it's really embarrassing. And so, yeah, of course, you know, of course, because that's what the mind does. But there's a working with relationship to the thinking and how we're perceiving the thinking, how we're the different ways that we're free from thinking or caught by thinking. And in Buddhist psychology, they don't really separate emotion from thought. It's kind of all of a piece. So if you're an emotion person, you can just substitute emotion for all this thinking talk. Same thing in this frame. That when we turn towards what's arising, when we're grounded in our seat, you know, and open in our heart, thought and emotion just is not as sticky, doesn't grab us. And naturally, you know, naturally there's wholeness. So maybe that's about enough for now. Yeah, how about a poem? A poem's a good antidote to Dogen. This is by Juan Ramon Jimenez, except translated. I am not I. Sounds like think not thinking already. I am not I. I am this one walking beside me, whom I do not see, whom at times I manage to visit, and whom at other times I forget, the one who remains silent when I talk, the one who forgives sweet when I hate. The one who takes a walk where I am not. The one who will remain standing when I die. Yeah. I am not I. I am this one walking beside me whom I do not see, whom at times I manage to visit and whom at other times I forget. The one who remains silent when I talk. The one who forgives sweet when I hate. The one who takes a walk where I am not, and the one who will remain standing when I die. Well, it's a blizzard of words. Do you have any comments or questions? We'll just talk for a few minutes, then we'll bow and get out of here.
I don't remember the exact words, but the last part of your new translation, as you were reading.
Should I read that whole thing again? Yeah. When a thought arises, bring it into spacious awareness. I might try to change it to better English, though. Anyway, sorry. When a thought arises, bring it into spacious awareness. Wake up to what is, and just then it ceases to exist. Take plenty of time, and taking plenty of time, forget all involvements. The self will naturally become whole. This is the vital art of sitting zazen.
And taking plenty of time is what is a wonderful recommendation, because what your mind tends to do is try to rush away from or solve or cramp up,
right,
and not have that time. So just say, take all the time you need, that you have all the time you need.
Yeah. Well, it's a generosity practice, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, giving ourselves the only thing we actually can give is time.
Yeah.
To yourself.
To yourself,
yeah. Right. Yeah, giving yourself time, yeah. And, you know, sometimes we blame our hurry-up culture and our iPods and all this, you know, for, like, sort of taking our time away. But really, it's our own, you know. It's our own responsibility, right? And I suppose that's the other message of this text, too, is take responsibility, you know. Take responsibility for your own life, your own body, your own thinking. You know, don't wait for somebody else to do this for you, because they can't, you know. So nobody else can give you time.
Yeah.
Right? And you can see people, you know, and we can create environments which seem to be more or less supportive of feeling this possibility of having enough time, you know, like, you know, quiet evening at the meditation hall, and we put a lot of energy into exactly how we set up this room and thought about it a lot, right, because of that. But That's not what does it, right? That's not what does it. It's just a support. Yeah. And then the one, Ramon Jimenez poem speaks to this too. You know, who is the one, you know, who is that one who is generous? You know, who is that one who is patient? Who is that one in us, you know, who give us everything we need, even though we're angry or constantly talking or forgetting, you know, all these things. And that reminds, there's quite a few Zen stories on this exact same theme, right? Like the famous story about not who's the one who's not busy. Who's the one who's not busy? I'll tell that another time. Chris?
I really appreciate your effort of retranslating this. The flavor to me is very different.
Yeah, it's quite different.
How do you think it, in our translation here, I'm the actor, I am making it happen.
In your translation, you
just hang with it and you give it time.
Yeah.
And I love the last sentence of it naturally happening. I don't have to beat anything down. I don't have to do something. If I just do the practice and with mindfulness, it's its own happening.
Right, yeah. Or sometimes you could say, you know, let the practice do you, right? Not you do the practice. Yeah.
So thank you.
Yeah, sure. Well, we can thank Mike Cross. So I'll put the link to this on the site, too. An English fellow who lived in Japan for a decade or two, and he did a lot of Dogen translation with a Japanese teacher, Mike Cross. He put a web page with Fukan Zengi character by character, so I'm completely just stealing from his work, and it's possible that he is misrepresenting some of these characters, and my thing's way off, but that's okay, you know. You get what you know, and that's the other thing that's really interesting to think about is this tradition comes to us through multiple cultures, right, in multiple languages, and some of the languages are hugely different, you know. It'd be one thing if it was like it came from France or something like that, you know. France to English is not such a big leap, but Chinese to Japanese to English is huge, you know, conceptual and linguistic leap. So who knows, you know? Who knows? So in some way, I mean, one hopes that we don't just sort of take this and make it into what's convenient to us, you know what I mean? Make it into sort of what we want so we'll feel good. And, you know, nothing wrong with feeling good, but there's a deeper possibility here, and I think there's a certain conservatism in the tradition, which sometimes people, it bothers people sometimes, you know? We don't want to change too much because there's something embedded in just the actual sort of way of holding our bodies that may be hard to sort of figure out with words. So it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, all these words and layers of translation and knowing and knowledge. Yeah.
I was really struck by your description of the separation referred to as pros and cons. And actually, for me, that was really emotional to realize that that's what I've been doing, you know, is sorting according to all these black and white principles. And the idea that I could spaciously hold that and become whole in a form is... makes living available to me in a way. I didn't really realize till tonight, so thank you very much. It's so easy to get stuck in beating yourself up because you have a negative feeling and it says let it go, and you're like, how do you do that? You know, it's very hard to do that sometimes. But holding it.
Yeah, and this spacious awareness. Yes. Remember that? Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Okay, well, anyone else want to say anything? Is that enough? Okay, there's a little chant to do at the end, and then we'll get up and bow, move our bodies. Excuse me for putting your body in one spot for so long. But it's actually the tradition. Norman was just reminding me about this the other day. There's one teacher in our lineage, Katagiri Roshi, who used to give really, really long talks on Dogen, like 2.5 hours long. And nobody could, and you couldn't understand him very well, but it was all just about, like, I don't know what, endurance or something like that. So anyway, so you got a little taste of that tonight, so I hope you enjoyed it. Okay, enough. Man.